Weiss, Weiss.
Weiss.
Weiss. I mean, I got it right on the first try, Mr. Hayes.
May it please the court. I would like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may. May I please the court? My name is Charles Hayden, and I represent Wayne Gibson Weiss, Jr., who is convicted in a jury trial in the Matthews County Circuit Court of one count of assault and battery on a family member, and received an active sentence of 9 months. We had assigned as error that the trial court failed to strike a juror who very explicitly stated he applied a different standard to men defendants as opposed to women defendants. He indicated that it was his belief that no man ever has a right to raise a fist to a woman. Mr. Weiss made a motion to strike for calause the nariman David Owens because Mr. Owens indicated it was, quote, his belief that no man ever has a right to raise a fist to a woman, unquote. When one of the other prospective jurors stated, it's just my belief that no man ever has a right to raise a fist to a woman, Owens endorsed that proposition. He said, I agree with that too. He explained his answer later. He says, I was taught all my life, you don't hit a woman, you don't hit a girl. He was asked, is there a different standard that you'd apply to for a man defending himself from a man against a woman, from a man defending himself against a man? And he replied, yes, and it's a different standard I apply.
Mr. Hayden, let me stop you. That's not his full answer, though. Aren't we supposed to take the entirety of the answers of the veneer person in order to determine whether there's a bias or not? And he goes on to say that, you know, it determines or depends on the size difference. It depends on whether she's got a weapon as to whether, you know, self-defense would apply. Doesn't that indicate that there is the consideration of factors to determine whether the defense is applicable?
Well, I'm quoting on the page 28 of the appendix when he's asked the question, is there a different standard that you would apply for a man defending himself from another man versus a man defending himself from a woman? He replies with a one-word answer, yes. There's no other. I'm not omitting the rest of his answer on that page. Now, he goes on for pages without, but we don't have time to discuss it.
Aren't we obligated to review the entire voir dire
instead of
isolated portions?
That's certainly correct, but I'm just simply noting the question that he gave was a categorical yes with no qualifications to that specific question. And so he goes on to say on page 30 of the appendix, he says, as between a big man and a little woman, if you're going to come in here and have a fist fight, yes, I believe it should be different. He says, reiterates, there's just a different standard that he would apply. He's never rehabilitated, and yet he remained on the panel, was not struck for cause. The defense counsel properly made an objection for cause, noting, quote, it seemed pretty plain to me that he was going to, that he's going to hold a different standard, you know, just based solely on the sex of one of the parties.
Did trial counsel object to that juror being
in panel?
On the panel?
No, but I would submit that Code Section 8.01-384 says that it shall be sufficient that a party at the time of ruling or order of the court is made or sought, makes known to the court the action which he desires the court to take, or his objections to the action of the court.
What about Spencer, 238 Virginia 295?
I would just simply note that Spencer case was a case where there was objections made to questions being propounded to jurors and restrictions on questions being put to...
Not to a specific juror.
Right, and that was exactly
Is that a distinction without a difference, or is that a real difference?
I think that's an important distinction because I note that I tried to, just typed into case finders, failed to object to the seating of a juror. I came up with two Court of Appeals cases where that language was specifically used. And both of those cases involve cases where the Commonwealth tried to make this objection to a voir dire that there was no, after an objection's made during voir dire, there's no final renewal of objection to the seating and paneling of the jury. In both those cases, the case I'll cite for you, that one was a published case, Salmon, S-A-L-M-O-N versus Commonwealth, 32 Virginia App, 586, 2000 case. The Court of Appeals stated in that case, the Commonwealth makes a procedural argument contending Salmon's claim is procedurally barred because he failed to object to the seating of the jury and thus waived any previous objections he had concerning the venari. The Commonwealth cites in support of his claim Spencer Reed versus Commonwealth, just like in this case.
And, Moomin versus Commonwealth, it cites that same language for Spencer when the question to the they objected to the jury being, that particular jury being placed on the panel, whether or not he was opposed to capital punishment.
Well, I have not read the Moomin case to see what the nature of the objection was there. But the Spencer case that was cited here, the Court of Appeals in the Salmon case says that goes to say that contention is without merit.
Well, as I understand Moomin, or however you pronounce it, whether jurors' views concerning capital punishment would prevent, not substantially impair, choosing one punishment or the other. Mm-hmm. Although the defendant had raised an objection on this ground during voir dire, he failed to object to the seating of any juror on that ground.
I would just note that in the Salmon case, they noted that Salmon complied with the requirements of Rule 5A18, which states no ruling of the court shall be considered as a basis for reversal unless objection was stated with grounds therefore at the time of ruling. They then cite the Moomin case. So they were saying, fully aware of the Moomin case, fully aware of the Spencer case, they said it that this objection, alleged failure to object to the seating of jury was without merit. And likewise,
can I have that cite, please?
That cite is 32 Virginia App, 586.
Is it, in the name of the case?
S-A-L-M-O-N. I guess it may be pronounced Salmon versus...
Say that again, please.
S-A-L-M-O-N versus Commonwealth. And then there's an unpublished case that also has that involved the same objection of not objecting to the seating of the jury, where that argument was propounded by the Commonwealth, that citing again Spencer, and they noted in that case that they rejected the argument in that case as well. And they noted, they distinguished Spencer in that case. They said, Spencer is distinguishable. In Spencer, the defendant only objected to questions or limitations on questions asked of individual jurors during voir dire.
Are you referring to the Murray case? The unpublished case that you're now talking about.
I'm referring to the Nelson case. That's a record 2004 unpublished case, Nelson versus Commonwealth. The record number is 3408022. And so they noted in that case, the Spencer case is distinguishable. They said in the Spencer, the defendant only objected questions or limitations on questions asked of individual jurors during voir dire. Defense counsel did not object in those cases to the jurors being sworn.
Isn't there a distinction between objection during voir dire objections to whether the potential juror could stand indifferent as opposed to whether or not the questions are inappropriate?
Well,
Spencer certainly talks about objecting to questions, but Moomin seems to say that this juror wouldn't be qualified on a capital murder case. Isn't there a big distinction there?
I respectfully don't think so. I think that cases applying this language of about making known the 384, it says it's sufficient that you make known your position, your objection to the juror, and no party after having made an objection or motion known to the court shall be required to make such an objection or motion again in order to preserve the right to appeal, challenge, or to challenge the ruling order or action of the court. They don't make an except in cases of voir dire, in which case you still have to renew the objection. They don't say that. They just state this flat rule that I think he's entitled to rely on. And certainly the cases applying the 801-384, the language there, they indicate that once a party makes known its objection to a particular ruling, there's no need for that party to, as a means of preserving its appeal rights, to note a formal exception or restate the objection. And I cite the cases of Ward Insurance versus Ward versus Insurance Company of North America, 253 Virginia 232, Richmond Department of Social Services versus Carter, 28 Virginia App 494, and Brown versus Commonwealth, 23 Virginia App 225, 1996 case. All those applying 801-384. And I submit the defense made his objection known to the court. It's not necessary to renew it with some kind of formal procedural nicety of object to the seating of the jury based on this objection to the one juror. So I think it's preserved. I'll reserve the balance of my time for me.
Thank you, Mr. Higgins.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I please the Court, Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. First, on the waiver, there is some confusion, conceitedly, in this area. In addition to Salmon, there's another Court of Appeals case, Hazel versus Commonwealth, 31 Virginia App 403, which basically says the same thing as Salmon. And importantly there, in each case, there was a challenge to the array. It was not to individual jurors. In one case, because the...
Counsel, let me stop you. In reference to Hazel, though, that was, again, not in reference to the objection to a seating of a juror. It was more specific in terms of question, just in the line of or ruling, very similar to Spencer.
The problems with Hazel and Salmon were, as I say, that the error alleged was the one that the Commonwealth had obtained criminal background checks on all the prospective jurors. And the other one was that during the course of the examination of the jurors, the Commonwealth had asked prejudicial questions and improper questions, which tainted the...
Right, but Hazel and Spencer both deal with questions, not a general objection to
exactly
the seating. So I guess what the question is, isn't there a distinction between those two cases and what we have here?
Exactly. That's my point. So we're talking here about individual jurors. And in Spencer, what the ruling of the court was that if a party objects to a ruling made during the voir dire of a particular juror, but subsequently fails to object to seating of the juror, he waives his objection.
But don't we have to look at what the facts are? The objection in Spencer is not to the individual juror. It's to a specific question that the defendant, Mr. Everhart, wanted to ask of that juror and was not allowed to ask. And the court essentially said, if you don't object to the seating of that juror, then you've waived the court's ruling on that particular question. Yes. Isn't that case inapplicable to...
Well, I'd say that I think Breard may be more effective because, in fact, in Breard, there was an attack on a particular juror. The judge said, "I deny that for now." It was not renewed, and there was no no objection to the panel being seated. So I think Brayard is a similar.
But that, again, not to make too fine of a point, is because there wasn't the renewal of the motion where the court sort of took it under advisement and nothing.
Well, the court, no. The court said, I deny that for now.
Okay.
And the defendants, I mean, in fact, did deny the motion to strike.
Mr. Murphy, it seems to me there's a substantial difference between objecting to a particular question and objecting to the suitability of a particular juror to sit on the panel.
I don't dispute that. Certainly there's a difference, Your Honor.
So where does that leave us with Spencer?
Well, I think, you know, Spencer involved the question. But the court did say that any ruling made with respect to a particular juror, that was not, was waived if it was not again raised at the opportunity when the jury...
If the challenge is to the juror's suitability to sit on the jury.
Well, I didn't say that, John. I mean, and I may be reading that statement too broadly, but I think they made that broad statement perhaps to indicate that it was not limited to that particular issue there, but to any situation where you point out problems either in the manner of questioning or in fact to the juror himself being biased, that you make that objection, it is denied, and then you do not raise it again. Now, I concede that there is a good deal of ambiguity in this area, and I suggest that, you know, the court can look to those facts, and I can't point to a particular case, unless it's Mumin, where in fact you refused to seat a juror and it was not renewed and it was waived. But I don't think in this case that's an essential point for the Commonwealth, because we do have a situation where, although the prospective juror did make some statements initially that might have indicated some form of improper view of the situation, the court pointed out, even the trial court pointed out, you know, it's difficult for a juror when he's faced with abstract questions. You know, would you defend yourself differently from a man or a woman? Many people would say yes. You know, because they have not yet been instructed on the principles they are required to follow, they're answering questions in the abstract and may be awkward for them to do so. So the judge indicated that, no, we've got to ask more questions, we've got to present them with the principles, and then see how he will do. And Mr. Owens did say that he would have to hear the facts, thought he could follow the instructions, that it would depend upon the whole scenario. That is not just on, you know, man or woman, but on the facts of what kind of force was being used, how big the parties were. Now that, you know, that is entirely proper, because if you look at the cases determining when reasonable force has been used in a self-defense situation, the court said you look to the size, the age, and to the gender. Because, you know, traditionally, often women are smaller, they may have less body muscle, and in fact, it may make substantial difference how you defend yourself. Whether, as you say, you're dealing in a situation where you have a big man and a small woman, it would certainly be reasonable to consider both the size and the gender. And I think that's all Mr. Owens was saying, is that ordinarily, you know, the moral principles are you shouldn't hit a woman, but then when we enter into self-defense, as he says at one point, well, a woman can shoot a gun as well as a man. So obviously you don't refuse to defend yourself from a woman, but if in fact your attacker is smaller than you are, you might respond differently than if you're attacked by a very large man. So I think that whatever confusion there was about his understanding of the self-defense standard, the court and the questioning, you know, once they had instructed him with the principles involved, that he, in fact, could follow those principles and was properly permitted to sit. And probably the bottom line here is that because this decision about whether the juror should have been placed on the jury can only be considered after the trial, the defendant has to show a manifest error. That is, he has to show that the leaving of this juror on the panel may have, in fact, adversely affected the outcome for him. And you look to what happened at trial, and the Court of Appeals has dealt with this situation in places where the juror has indicated he might give too much deference to police testimony, that he might consider a police officer more than somebody else, some other witness. And they've looked at the trial and said, well, in this particular case, nothing that the police officer said involved any credibility determination. It was just, he relied on facts. So whether or not they gave too much credence to the officer didn't make any difference. Here the issue was, would Mr. Owens apply the wrong self-defense standard? Well, if you look at the defendant's testimony, he never indicates that he struck the woman or did anything else. His testimony was that he grabbed her arms and gently lowered her to the ground. If you look at the closing argument, defense counsel did not argue self-defense. He just argued that the victim's testimony was inherently incredible, that it couldn't have happened the way she said it happened. And I think for that reason, whether or not Mr. Owens was improperly placed on the jury, the defendant cannot show the required manifest error.
Counsel, it wasn't a self-defense instruction, though. I understand that those arguments were not made, and I understand the distinction of the testimony given by the appellant, but wasn't there a self-defense instruction that was
given? Yes, indeed, it was given. I mean, but the point is that...
I understand your point.
Right, it was certainly given. I mean, it was certainly possible the lawyer could certainly have argued self-defense, but chose not to. And I think the reason, because he didn't argue it seriously, we can't really believe that the jury would have convicted on acquitted on self-defense if Mr. Owens had not been on the jury. So I think that's what they have to show, that it would have made a difference. I don't see how in this case it could possibly have made any difference to the outcome of the trial. And unless there are further questions from the court, I'll ask that the decision below be affirmed.
Thank you.
Your Honor, it was suggested that Mr. Weiss's defense counsel didn't raise self-defense as an issue in the final argument, but it clearly was an issue, the instruction. Also, Mr. Weiss's testimony, when he testifies on page 138 of the appendix, he denies having committed an assault and battery on Amanda Love and insists that he instead only acted to repel an assault upon him by Love. He says, I never smacked, hit, kicked, or kneed Amanda Love ever. I merely forced her to the ground because it didn't feel like getting punched in the face. I know how hard she can hit from the past. I don't want to be hit again in the face. So to protect myself, I took her to the ground by wrestling. I mean, I knew what I was doing. I did not hurt her. And so he said, I never assaulted her. And he says on page 141. So clearly he's making the issue that he used reasonable self-defense to protect, to repel an attack upon his person. And if this juror is sitting there saying, you can't touch a woman physically, that's just beyond the bounds, well, that he may have been influenced by this improper standard. I've noted the case law that although a trial court's ruling upon challenge for cause is entitled to great weight on appeal, any reasonable doubt as to the juror's qualification should be resolved in favor of the accused. Doubts as to the impartiality of a juror must be resolved in favor of the accused. I cited the case Educational Books, 3 Virginia 384. Borderline objections should always be resolved in favor of disqualification. I cited other cases for that. And I think that applied here, should have applied, but wasn't applied in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden. We will come down and greet counsel.